Welcome to Journey to Success Radio. This is Tom Tuttle Cunningham. I'm the founder of Journey to Success Radio, also creator of the Journeys to Success book series, international bestseller series on Amazon, and of course the world's most well-known Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. Find out more about the show at journeytosuccessradio.com. This is an exciting show because it's going to be interesting, let's say that. My guest today is Don Head. Don Head was appointed Commissioner of the Correctional Service of Canada on June 27, 2008. He began his federal public service career as a correctional officer in 1978 in the Pacific region. He's held various operational and managerial positions between 1978 and 1995. He worked in four federal penitentiaries. He has received numerous commendations and awards throughout his career, including the Governor General's Corrections Exemplary Service Medal and Bar and the Public Service Award of Excellence for Diversity and Employment Equity. Wow, that's a great award to have, especially in this day and age. Welcome to the show today, Don.
Thank you very much, Tom. Great to be here.
I appreciate you being on the show, and mainly my idea when I approached you was that even in correction service, I know there are many good things happening, and let's help dispel some myths, get some positivity into what you're doing, because my wife worked for a criminal defense lawyer for 9 or 10 years here in the Mississauga area, and she knows that there's, you know, there are good things going on. But the public doesn't talk about them. So let's talk the actual realities of the correctional environment. As I'm sure you know, and probably everybody actually knows, it's not like you see on TV, and it's probably not even like it is in reality in the U.S. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely an accurate statement. You know, most people draw their conclusions about how correctional environments work by watching shows like Oz or Orange is the New Black or movies like Shawshank Redemption, and people believe that that reflects the reality in correctional environments, not only Canada but around the world.
Right, and the reality is that you got good people and you don't treat them the way they're seen on TV. And so let's talk about people, because corrections is about people, not only the people that are in prison, but also the people that are serving them or in the prison or employees. So really your purpose is to help turn lives around and reduce recidivism. I guess I said that right. I've said it before a few times. You really don't want to be a warehouse for repeat offenders. My wife used to call them frequent flyers because she would often get the same people numerous times over the years. And so talk about the people, because really your purpose, although it would put you guys out of business maybe, is to turn lives around and reduce those people coming back to see you.
Exactly, Tom. You know, the unofficial motto that we adopted a number of years ago is changing lives, protecting Canadians. And we focus on the changing lives piece. Our staff work very hard with individuals who have faced many challenges in their lives, come into conflict with the law and end up getting a custodial sentence. They may start off in the provincial or territorial system and then end up in the federal system. And by the time that we receive them and start to work with individuals, they've got a long list of issues and needs that have not been addressed. So things such as mental health problems, substance abuse problems, violence problems, family violence problems, sexual offending behaviors that haven't been addressed because their time in the provincial territorial system has been relatively short, and the provinces and territories just unfortunately are not necessarily resourced well enough to address their needs, nor do the individuals stay in the provincial system long enough for them to get the kind of assistance that they need. Mind you, this isn't a plea to give everybody long sentences so they come to us, but it's really about making sure that the kinds of supports and programs are available to people at the earliest point that those needs are identified.
Amen. My wife actually has a client In jail for murder. Long story, but anyway, he's going to get out soon. He said he's going to write a letter to Corrections Service for basically the blessing and the saving of his life. And the kids get the kids that he left behind killed his wife get money. And he said it was just an amazing, you know, it was a good experience for him. And he said, you know, really it saved his life and his kid's life. And he really speaks highly of the system. Let's talk about a few things that are pretty topical. Well, should be always topical. Women offenders. I don't really think about that a lot, but he must have to have a different approach to a women's correctional institution than a man's.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, one of the things that that we've seen over the years is that the women offender population has been growing at a rate greater than the population for men. There's a couple of reasons for that. One of them is primarily because the courts have seen that the Federal Correctional Service of Canada offers the types of programs and services that the women need. And this is more than just those services or programs that address the what we call the criminogenic needs, the kinds of things that led them to coming into conflict with the law. But they also address some of the issues the women have faced throughout their life, such as their own personal trauma. So we've actually seen cases where judges have had the choice between giving a provincial sentence and a federal sentence, and the judge has chosen to give a federal sentence because of the types of programs, the availability of programs in our facilities. And as well, we've actually seen in cases where the women themselves have asked to come to a CSC for the very same reason, to get the support and assistance that they need. And, you know, we currently have, up until the mid-1990s, there was only one federal prison for women, and that was in Kingston, which was called the Prison for Women. And then in the 90s, we started building regional facilities. So there are five regional women's facilities across the country, plus one facility in Nikanik First Nations territory down just south of Maple Creek, Saskatchewan, that is a healing lodge for women.
Wow. Nice. Wow. So let's talk about Aboriginal offenders. As you said, you had mentioned Northwest Territories and that area not well funded. What are you doing? And again, just like women, you need to have cultural specific penitentiary or prison for Aboriginal offenders, right?
Yeah, exactly. One of the most disheartening facts about our business is that the number of Indigenous offenders, Aboriginal offenders, is grossly disproportionate to the representation in mainstream society. So we're, the average is about 3-5% of the Canadian population are of Indigenous descent. 25-26% of the population, the federal incarcerated population, are Indigenous offenders.
Wow.
So grossly misrepresented. And, you know, there's all kinds of theories and reasons for that. But having said that, one of the things that that we do is to look at, the overall needs of those individuals and to give them a choice to either follow a programming approach that recognizes their cultural and spiritual needs, or follow the mainstream programming approach. And in terms of what we'd call the traditional Aboriginal approach, we would have, for example, we would employ elders across the country to come in and to work with the men and women. We have healing lodges specifically for Indigenous men in BC and in Alberta. We have some arrangements with some First Nations communities that provide what we call Section 81 accommodation and programming opportunities. So Otrichakisipi up in Manitoba, Prince Albert Grand Council in Saskatchewan, Native Counseling Services in Alberta. So we have arrangements with community organizations and communities to provide space and services for Indigenous offenders. We have a number of programs that we offer which are specifically tailored for Indigenous offenders that, like I say, address their spiritual and cultural needs. So although they have the choice of going to either the mainstream or the Aboriginal specific programs, the ones that are specific to Aboriginal offenders incorporate more learnings and teachings and culture and have elder involvement.
Wow, that's a significantly disproportionate percentage of the population, and so yeah, you certainly need to help them in a way that's familiar with their culture and what they've been brought up with. So wow, very cool. I bet 0% of the population, of the Canadian population, knows that, unless, well, I guess if you're an Aboriginal, you would. But that's kind of new for me, and that's an amazing approach. And you got some great cooperation from the Aboriginal community as well. So when you get cooperation from them, and then you have a culturally specific program for them, it must make things much better, or lower recidivism. I bet we can probably talk for days even about how you could get in to young people and prevent them from even getting in the system, but that would be a long discussion. But amazing what you're doing, and I imagine for sure it's got to help with recidivism and getting people back into their culture without being hardened by what they would see in a different facility.
No, exactly. And I mean, one of the things that we're going to be pursuing in this coming year, which I'm really excited about, is the is working on the issue of enhancing Indigenous vendors' employment skills.
Mm.
And we're in the early stages of framing some approaches and some projects where we hope to, again, be working very closely with some of the First Nations communities across the country, and having our offenders learn how to build modular homes that in turn can be built right in the First Nations community. So we'll be addressing the needs of the offenders in terms of giving them employment skills that that will help them get jobs when they go out, and at the same time hoping to address the housing needs that we see in many of the First Nations communities across the country. So I'm quite excited about this initiative. If it all comes together over the coming year, we're going to have a positive impact on a lot of lives.
Wow, that's a very cool initiative. Not only are you teaching them trades, and in this day and age, in my opinion, trades are more important than college or university. You teach them a trade, but not only when they go to apply for a job, maybe they've done 3, 4, 5, 10 houses, so they have experience. The people they apply to can have pictures of the houses. They could have references from whoever was watching over them, supervising them, and so that would be amazing. Right away when they get out, they have the education and enough training in it to know, you know, for people to know that they're good at what they are applying for.
No, exactly, and you know, giving back to the community, and for many of the offenders, you know, they know that, you know, they've done something wrong, and they really do want to find a way of giving back to the community at large. And you know what, I can't think of a better way, although they're working on their own skills to help them get a job, but to know that they contributed in a way that is giving a house or creating a house for a family to live in, you can't think of a better way to give back to a community.
Wow, it's a cool variation on what's a Habitat for Humanity.
Exactly.
Very cool variation. Let's talk about another thing, interesting topic, mental health. It's more in the news. It's more acceptable to talk about than it used to be. My wife and I were laughing the other day. Her mother's 92, and she has dementia. And my wife was saying, yeah, back in the old days, they used to call that hardening of the arteries, because they didn't know much about mental health. But now it's more open for people, and one of the greatest receptions I get, and people come speak to me privately after when I speak, is, you know, if you live in chronic pain every second of every day since you're 5, you're going to have some periods of depression. And then my wife, working criminal defense, there's a lot of people with legitimate mental health challenges, and yeah, what they did is illegal, but they have some legitimate mental health problems. And then, of course, your staff, like, I imagine working in a penitentiary can wear you down mentally after some time. So what do you do mental health-wise for both the offenders and for your staff as well?
No, you're right on, Tom. Both components are extremely important. You know, as you pointed out, for us, the issue of mental health amongst the offender population is a significant concern. You know, conservative estimates suggest that, you know, 13, 14, 15% of the male offender population have some mental health problem, and with the women offender population, off the numbers, it can easily be double that for both groups.
Right. Hey, Don, even I have mental health problems from time to time. So.
You know what? I think at the end of the day, we all experience some mental health, problems, and our overall mental resilience, suffers at some point because of, some significant emotional or traumatic event. And, you're absolutely right, Tom. It's kind of interesting. When I first started in 1978, this is not something that we would have talked about. Definitely wouldn't have talked about it as it relates to ourselves as staff members, and it was very rarely talked about in relation to offenders in the system. And if it was, it was only the more severe or acute cases. Those suffering from schizophrenia or even what we call dementia today. Mm-hmm. Those more severe kinds of cases, and they would have gone to one of our five regional psychiatric centers across the country. But as a result of a number of very serious and tragic incidents over the last number of years, we have spent a lot of time and energy investing in tools to do mental health screening, vision of programs, not only for the acute cases, but also for intermediate mental health needs, and looking not only to ensure that we've got program support and clinical support in the institutions, but making sure that we've got the right bridging in place as individuals transition back out into the community. And that's always been a concern for us, is that even in the early days when we were doing limited work, and now that we're more currently doing a lot more work in relation to mental health programs and clinical services, is to make sure that we've got those individuals lined up when they go back in the community and they don't regress, unfortunately fall back into a cycle that may lead them into conflict with the law. From a staff perspective, again, you're absolutely right. There is the issue of mental health within the workforce is only a conversation that's been out in the open in the last couple of years. When I first started, if you went through a significant traumatic event, if you'd been involved in a riot or a hostage taking or a murder in an institution, what was expected is that, as a staff member, that's your job, you're there, you do it, suck it up, and come back to work the next day. Hmm. Not really realizing, the psychological, mental resilience impact on staff. So it's almost a couple of years ago now, I pushed the agenda specifically in the Correctional Service of Canada to look at what we should and could be doing along those lines. And we've been working in partnership with the Mental Health Commission with Canada. We've implemented a program now. It's called the Road to Mental Readiness for all our staff. It's helping to look at, yourself as well as your colleagues, and to be able to, sort of gauge where you sit on the overall mental health continuum on an hourly, daily, weekly, monthly basis. And we're just in the process now of expanding that program to include a peer support component, also a component for family members of staff, because a staff member who's been involved in a traumatic incident or a situation, occupational stress injury incident, as we call it, their family may not recognize that somebody may be struggling internally with those things. So we're going to be looking at how we expand the program to make information available to family members, and then also ultimately to retirees as well, because we have individuals who do 20, 25, 30, 35 years of a service in corrections and go off and retire, and sometimes find they're struggling with things and not realizing that it may be linked to an occupational stress injury, a mental health injury.
Wow, and you kind of read my mind on the next question I was thinking of, because I thought any mental health challenge of a staff member affects probably their family more than their necessarily their job, and so any work you do to help them with that and their family kind of makes the family life a lot better. And we, you don't want strife in family and kids because of what they encounter on a daily basis in their job.
No, exactly. And in our world, when you get through a day where nothing happens, that is an absolutely great thing. But there are days when stuff happens, and people internalize and deal with that differently. And if you have individuals, family members that work in this kind of profession, and or other law enforcement professions as well. And if they come home and they're quiet and they're not talking or sharing, it's usually a sign that they're struggling with something. And so, you know, having family members, helping them to be informed about what to look for and watch for, you know, is a good first step. And because if an individual is coming home and struggling, there's no question it's going to play out in a negative way in back home on the family front.
Right. Now, let's brag about Canada. I speak around the world. I brag on Canada. I call it the greatest country in the world. I've been in hospital 40 times and cost myself and my family the same thing each time. And so happy to pay my taxes, because when you've been in that often, you're probably, I'm in the hole a lot. But what an amazing country we live in. And I'm sure even in the corrections industry, Canada is probably viewed very well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I agree with you. As a country, Canada, as far as I'm concerned, ranks up there as the best in the world. I've, throughout my personal and professional career, I've traveled to 159 different countries. And from a you know, a day-to-day life perspective, from a business perspective, a correctional perspective, and every time I come home, similar to you, I'm just thankful that I live in Canada, I work in Canada, and my family gets to grow up in Canada. You know, it sometimes, and don't get me wrong, even within our organization, there's a lot of room for improvement, and we continually look at how we can do things better, more effectively, more efficiently, and ultimately ensure that we're, you know, supporting the needs of offenders, addressing the needs of victims, ensuring that communities are safe in the long run. So we always have, you know, there's always room for improvement. But having said that, we have a lot of countries that are knock on our door and are looking for our assistance in terms of, you know, how we do assessments of offenders, how we deliver programs, just even provide overall leadership within a correctional environment. You know, we're currently working with countries like the Bahamas, Trinidad and Tobago, Namibia. We're going to be doing some work in Sierra Leone and Mozambique. We belong to several international associations of correctional leadership, where Canada, and specifically the Correctional Service of Canada, is seen as a world leader. We have some of the most amazing correctional researchers in the world, you know, published and peer-reviewed, and their work leads to significant change in various countries around the world. Our program developers and facilitators, again, are seen as world-class and called upon to come and provide assistance in other jurisdictions. So we have, it's amazing, you sometimes have to leave your country to gain an appreciation as to how well things are going, because it's so easy within your own country for people to criticize, you know, you're not doing this or you're not doing that right. But when you step outside of that world and hear how others view you, you feel good. I mean, the one thing, Tom, I can say quite proudly is that every day when I get up in the morning, you know, I read 12 different papers. I read the situation reports from the last 24 hours. And, of course, newspapers and situation reports are usually filled with
negative news.
But the one thing that allows me to sort of reposition, recenter myself is knowing the fact that each and every day, 19,000 good news stories are being authored across the country. We have 19,000 CSC staff who come to work each and every day, committed to doing the most professional job that they can, and they all want to author their work in excellence,
right,
and sign their work in excellence. And so I know there are 19,000 good news stories that that occur. And to be honest, I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you, to be able to share just a little bit off the top of some of the good work that the staff in the Correctional Service of Canada are doing.
They do an amazing job, and even though negative news networks always love to share the bad stuff, there's probably 98% good and 2% bad, but you don't know that percentage from the media. And I was thinking, and I tell audiences, I tell my wife, you know, when she complains, and even when I complain, I say that no matter what challenge you go through in life, you are better going through it in Canada than almost any other country in the world. Specifically, I speak of about my rheumatoid arthritis, but I imagine Canadian corrections is the exact same thing. If you have to end up in a corrections institution, you are probably much better off in Canada than most of the countries of the world.
No, exactly. I mean, you look at some of the places that that we've been, and they have their challenges, you know, from an economic perspective, a social perspective, a political perspective. But I've been in places where plumbing doesn't exist, where food for offenders has to be brought in by family members from the outside. Staff members, forget about uniforms; they don't even have shoes or boots to wear. So I've been in places like that, and you know, even a number of years ago when I was down in Haiti before the earthquake at the major penitentiary there, and 3,000 offenders crowded in a space that was only built for 300. And the one thing that they needed was something to be able to move the garbage each day that's produced by 3,000 people. What they had were basically just a stick to push all this garbage. It sounds rather strange and bizarre, but I came back, we purchased a dozen or so Canadian snow shovels, if you can imagine, to send to Haiti so that the inmates could have something that they could use to shovel the garbage, but at the same time not use as weapons against anybody. And we sent them these dozen Canadian snow shovels. And to be honest, you would have thought that we had given them a huge pot of gold.
Right. I experienced that in Cambodia. I gave someone $5 for doing something for me, and her eyes almost popped out of her head. And I was thinking, like, this is $5. Why are you looking at me like that? And then someone told me, well, she probably earns $80 a month working 60 hours a week, and so your $5 meant a lot.
Exactly.
One last question, personal one. I've never heard parents say, when my Donnie grows up, he's going to be a correctional services person. I've rarely heard someone stand at the top of the class or front and say, when I grow up, I want to be Commissioner of Correctional Service of Canada. How did this interest or purpose, if you spent this much time in it, it's more than an interest, it's a passion and a purpose. How did it first come to you? Were your parents like, you know, you could be a lawyer or a doctor or something? Talk about that, because it's not often, as I said, that you ever hear people say, well, I'm going to get in the correctional services industry.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I was, when I left high school, I went into the military, and there for a few years, and then very quickly there was a downsizing occurring. So it was a case of sort of last in, first out kind of consideration. So I started looking around for what kind of employment was available, and that time BC, British Columbia Corrections, provincial hiring, and federal corrections was hiring, and in those days it was called the Canadian Penitentiary Service. And so I applied to both. BC Corrections said I was too young and didn't have any life experience. Federal Corrections said you're exactly the kind of person that we want. And next thing you know, my career in corrections started back in 1978. And to be honest, I haven't looked back since then. And I have to be honest, I've never actually aspired to this job at all. I can remember being a young correctional officer and sitting in the front entrance control post with other colleagues, and we'd always joke, you know, when I'm commissioner, I'm going to change this. And it's funny as time went on, and 30 years later, I became the commissioner. There was actually a couple of individuals who I started work with. They had retired, but called me up and said, do you remember in 1978 you said you were going to change? I think the thing that probably impressed me the most and has kept me in the organization, it comes back to the very thing that we talked about at the beginning, is the people. There are amazing people that come to work in federal corrections, provincial corrections, and territorial corrections each and every day. Dedicated, committed people that want to do a professional job, people that want to make a difference, and people who literally put up with some of the most amazing, difficult, challenging, dangerous things that most Canadians wouldn't imagine.
Right.
You know, I go back that those references about shows like Oz and Shawshank Redemption, all those things that you see happen in an hour or two don't happen each and every single day. There are the odd times that do happen, and to watch these amazing group of people come together, they come together like a family and work to support each other, to make sure that people are safe at the end of the day and they're able to get back on track and to ultimately make a difference in people's lives and protect Canadians.
Amazing. And I imagine teamwork is even more important in correctional services, because you need more encouragement, positivity, support. The outside world doesn't really know what you go through. And so everybody needs to do their job for the safety. But if everybody helps each other with their mental health, their enjoyment of the job, and the people they work with, that must make a big difference too.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, at the end of the day, Tom, you actually have an extended family. Mm-hmm. My extended family includes 19,000 people. It's like every family. You have a dysfunctional Uncle Don or a crazy Aunt Mary, whatever the case may be, but when that family needs to come together, they come together, and you see that day in and day out in our organization, and not only are they a team, like I say, they truly are a family.
Right, and you need that family, because the outside world really doesn't really have an honest perception of what their job and life is like. If you say, well, I'm a software engineer, or I manufacture this or that, you know, like, okay, they picture that in their head. But when you say, I work for correctional services, they're probably thinking something that they saw recently on TV or something different than what the reality is.
Yeah, people either go to one of two conversations. They either want to know about some name of an offender that's been in the media quite a bit, and they want to know, like, well, do you know inmate so-and-so or inmate this or that? Or they just go quiet.
Right.
They
walk away.
Exactly.
I gotta go get a drink. I'll see you, sir.
Exactly.
what was your name again? All right, talk to you later. All right. But then you could also be like my wife. Like, I love to let her loose at a party. Tell them the story about this person and the thing that they did. And, you know, she has some hilarious stories about people that deserve to be in prison because they're just too dumb. But, you know, I can just get her started. Everybody's like, oh, wow. So I'm sure you have a lot of funny stories as well, where you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe someone actually did that.
No, it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, you see things. You see things happen, and you can't believe that human behavior is what it is.
Right. Well, amazing talking to you, Don. I'm glad to get all these topics out. Even in correctional service, the main focus, the main purpose is positivity, is getting people out, getting people working and with skills and trades, getting people so they don't come back and see you. And you've been able to segment it for different cultural things, the Aboriginals or women and mental health. And then, of course, Canada is amazing country, and we're viewed well internationally, and so nice to have all those things out for the public to hear, to negate a lot of the negative news networks of the world that might tell you otherwise.
Well, thank you, Tom, and absolutely a pleasure talking to you and sharing the great work that the staff of the Correctional Service Canada do.
Right, and thank all 19,000 of them for me. Amazing job. We live in a great country, very secure, and a lot of that is because of the work they do.
Most definitely. I'll definitely pass on your thanks.
Amazing. Have a great day, Don. Thanks so much.
Take care, Tom.